Amy and I have been friends since graduate school. We actually have never been on a panel together, so we're happy. And Amy should be happy because she's the one who wrote me into this. But thank you to Amy and Patrick and David and everyone else who's done really a fantastic job of organizing this. And I do think this is a brilliant way to introduce a digital archive by having people really work in the archive and see what they come up with. And so I'm happy, I'm honored really to have been included. I actually struggled a lot writing this paper. And so I thought I would take this as an opportunity for a little sort of broader contextualization of what I wrote and maybe a little self-criticism and think about how I can rework this for publication. And for those of you who haven't had the opportunity to read the paper yet, what I do is I look at how Kentuckians wrote about food in this, what I describe as an interrelated stew of status and loyalty and security and identity. And I contrast the diaries of a couple of elite women, Josie Underwood and Lizzie Hardin, whose diaries are full of lavish details of the food that they're eating and the food that they're preparing for soldiers and for people in hospitals, and then with the way that food and hunger appeared in the governor's papers. So I'm in the early stages of a new project about starvation and the meaning of food in the Civil War South. And so when Patrick and Amy approached me last year, I thought that this would be a really great laboratory for me to work through some of my ideas. And I did know that Kentucky wasn't part of the Confederacy and therefore wouldn't necessarily be part of the larger project. But I also think that as we were talking about this morning, Kentucky is in a really unusual position in that it shared, because of the guerrilla war, it shared a lot of experiences with parts of the Confederacy. So historians know that the Confederacy ran out of food over the course of the war, and it seems like a conundrum, given that it was an agricultural society. It actually, if you start to dig into it, isn't all that surprising. Because hunger and starvation are really, they're political problems as much or more than they are problems of agriculture, right? So there was usually enough to eat in the Civil War South as a whole, but not necessarily in any given place, and not necessarily at prices that people could afford. And that a lot of the problems that people faced in the Civil War South are problems actually of supply, they're problems of the movement of foodstuffs from one part of the Confederacy to another. And then increasingly, as the war goes on, it's the problem of losing a labor supply as enslaved workers run away. And so the reason that I came to this project, which I guess actually is answering some of Leanne's question, it grew out of a bunch of ideas that have been kind of sloshing around in my head for a while. The first of which actually grew out of my dissertation and my first book, where I looked at Confederate identity and Confederate nationalism during the war and Reconstruction, the early years of Reconstruction. And while I was doing that work, I was really fascinated by the ways that white Southerners faced shortages of foods and manufactured goods, and how they used the language of nationalism and patriotism to justify using substitutes and to encourage one another to use substitutes. So homespun dresses, for example, instead of imported fabrics, and this whole range of modified foodstuffs. I didn't really do very much with this at the time, and in fact, my dissertation committee actually urged me to take that whole section out of the book, which I did. My dissertation advisor's laughing now. which I did, but if you know me, you know that it's, I never really throw things away. And actually, very deep in sort of a file and a file and a file and a file in my hard drive, I actually still have the section that I cut. So I also, over the years, have become increasingly interested in culinary history and particularly Southern food. But I've also, in a way that I find I'm frustrated with a lot of this kind of reflexively celebratory, ahistorical way that Southern food is talked about, particularly in popular culture. All of this like biscuits, and barbecue, and oh my God, bacon, and like And then a lot of it, I think, is just reflexively celebratory rather than sort of probing the darker side and the more interesting to me side of food, which is like, who's actually preparing the food? Who gets credit for it? Things like that. I don't know how many pieces of work this is, but a lot of the culinary history of the Civil War is really pitched at the popular reader too, in the form of novelty cookbooks or kind of glossy gift books that have like, you know, make your own hardtack or like make your own stew. And they pull from a range of sources, but they're really descriptive. They're not particularly argument driven. They're more about like, you know, my dad loves the Civil War and I don't know what to give him, so I will give him the Civil War cookbook, right? Like that kind of book. The last kind of piece that really fed into it came from actually my second project, which was looking at the ways that Americans remembered Sherman's March. And what I came to realize was that food was really significant to this event, not just actually and materially, but it's really symbolically important as well. And that food, the presence of food in regions that had been relatively untouched by the war, defined Sherman's campaign as he let his soldiers loose to, as he put it, forage liberally on the countryside. And the degree to which the march did or didn't lay waste to certain areas of the countryside, I think, is really contested today. It's a huge subject of my book. So all of that kind of put together meant that I wanted to write a look at starvation in the Civil War South through the lens of culinary history, this deep dive into what people in the Civil War era South actually ate during the war, and then also kind of in the first couple of years of Reconstruction through the famines of 1865 and 67. And I wanted to do it not just looking at the few published Confederate cookbooks there are from this very elite perspective, or from the perspective of soldiers, but I also wanted to try to incorporate poor whites and African Americans. I wanted to really kind of dig deep and say, okay, what do people actually eat when they are facing hunger, and what does that all mean? So that was the background with which I then came to the governor's papers. And I'm a pretty linear thinker, and so I approached the documents really systematically. I think it's been really interesting to hear how everyone kind of dove into it. But I'd done some basic work on Confederate and Southern culinary history, and I looked through the Kentucky Housewife, which is actually one of a handful of specifically Southern cookbooks that were published in the antebellum era. And I was really struck, actually, the Kentucky Housewife has something like 1,300 recipes in it, and a huge variety of food that Kentuckians were eating at the time, things that I never really thought of, but they're eating eggplant, for example. I didn't really think they had that. So when I turned to the governor's papers, I had some ideas about what I thought I was going to find. I thought I would find the sorts of letters that historians have mined in the past, ones to Confederate government officials, for example, complaining of hunger, asking for furloughs. Amy's actually written a great article about these kinds of articles. Paul Eskett used them a long time ago. And so I made a list of about 60 words to search in the archives. But I started with sort of broadly conceptual ones like food, hunger, starvation, subsistence shortage, just trying to see what I hit from there. And I got a lot. And then I also started looking for specific food stuff. So wheat and flour, corn, hog, and all the hog associated words. This is what I have 3 pages of this. Cattle, all the other kinds of meats, fruits and vegetables, and then like your beverages, coffee, milk, tea, whiskey, which, you know, we learned a lot about tippling. And I found a lot of references, actually. I couldn't, where I ran into trouble then was how did I like try to make a coherent narrative out of what I found, at least in ways that I felt like hadn't been done before. Because what I didn't want to write was just like, I looked at 60 food-related words and here's what I came up with. Which I found a real struggle. Certainly what I found was that the disruption of guerrilla war led to hunger. What I also found, though, was that there were not a lot of documents that really touched on hunger and starvation directly. That it was often more oblique. That in a lot of petitions, for example, there would be hunger or starvation would be one in a list of sort of seemingly secondary consequences. Often in a request to have a fine for another crime, assault, disorderly housing, Crystal's going to talk about tippling, Luther talked about. But the language really seemed kind of boilerplate a lot of the time. And then there also were a bunch of complaints about having to support the troops, whether they were having to support guerrillas, whether they were having to support Kentucky militia, the sense of being eaten out of house and home, although, and to backtrack, after I finished looking through the governor's papers, that's when I turned to the diaries of Lizzie Harden and Josie Underwood, one who's a unionist, one who's a Confederate sympathizer. And these complaints are frankly much less eloquent in the governor's papers, which is interesting. There was a little side moment where there's the whole interplay of hogs and the business of distilling, where, of course, many of you are Kentuckians, you all probably know this, right? You distill and then you feed the mash to your hogs, and then the Kentuckians were selling hogs to the Union Army, and I was really excited for about a minute or two about the great Kentucky hog swindle until I discovered that there was a pretty comprehensive article already written about the great Kentucky hog swindle. And then there were these receipts sometimes for supplies that people had purchased. So when I finally kind of came to put it all together were this notion that what Kentuckians are doing as they're writing to the government or as they're engaging with the government on these issues of food really has to do with claiming that the state has a responsibility to protect them from hunger. And also, and this is where I got my title, literally destroyed as a housekeeper, this implication that being able to control food and control the food of your household has implications for the notion of being a protector, being mastery and control. And so the person, if you haven't read the paper, who's literally destroyed as a housekeeper was actually a man who had guerrillas raid his house and take everything, even his teacups. And that's how he was described. And so I'll kind of stop there because what I'm really interested in hearing is A, if the paper worked with these sort of bifurcation, and B, if not, what should be a useful through line.